Violence in the streets of our nation takes many forms. Last Saturday, in a suburb of St. Louis, Ferguson, Missouri, 18-year-old Michael Brown lost his life in a police shooting that is still under investigation. The outpouring of rage and grief on the part of Ferguson's African-American community was immediate and quickly polarized into solemn vigils, but also into some violent protests. Joining me to talk about the events in Ferguson this past week, as well as the work that his excellent organization is doing around some of the racial issues raised by this shooting, is Pastor Mike McBride. He leads Lifelines to Healing, part of the PICO Network. Pastor Mike, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Great to be here with you again, Reverend, and everyone.
You've been out front, as we would expect you to be, suggesting that this level of conflict is an inevitable outcome of avoiding a conversation on race in this country that needs to happen. Mike, let's start right there, and you expand on that, if you will.
There are, as Dr. Martin Luther King says, two Americas. Well, there's one America that is beautiful for situations, flowing with resources and opportunities. And there's another America that does not experience the sunlight of opportunity, that is not beautiful, but rather very ugly and painful and destructive. And our inability as a country to have a constructive conversation about the reality of these two Americas still existing, I think is feeding a very negative underbelly of division that these kinds of tragic incidents, as frequently as they continue to happen, it is feeding a very sad and dangerous environment, all because we refuse to talk about the issues of race, the issues of class, and the ways in which the structures and the systems of our country.
What kind of culture develops in the absence of honest conversations about race?
So I will tell you, from my own personal experience, very concretely, I am grown up in a Christian household with both of my parents, never been arrested. I was a Bible college student in the city of San Jose. Driving home one night, two white police officers pulled me over and proceeded to physically and sexually assault me because they were threatened by my presence, my behavior, after they reached through my legs and grabbed my groin area. That kind of consistent racial profiling, stop and frisk, these kind of consistent encounters that many, 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 overwhelmingly majority number of African-American, particularly men, have every single day, reaches a boiling point. It reaches a place of such high frustration, but not frustration and solely anger, but fear. And I think what people who have never been physically detained or assaulted by the police will never understand is the dehumanization one feels before, during, and after such an encounter. While it may not make sense for folks to respond in these incidents with such rage and potentially belligerent behavior, it's because many people are getting back in touch with a kind of pain and violation, and they never had an opportunity to say it was wrong because the law enforcement person or the security person or whoever has been able to get off and go on about their business every day, and we've been left with that experience. The inability for us to at least acknowledge that as an experience that people are facing every single day, to acknowledge that that is a racialized experience, to acknowledge that the response in Ferguson versus the response with the Bundy ranchers in Arizona or the western part of the country are deeply racialized, to not be able to acknowledge that and understand what that is about is fueling, I believe, a very dangerous chasm of experience and understanding in our country. And people of faith have to lead this conversation. We have to step and lean into it because we are equipped, I believe, with a higher calling and a higher mandate to see one another beyond these stereotypes, beyond these racialized barriers, but we have to do it by engaging with one another. And our country is dropping the ball, I believe, from the federal government all the way down.
Doesn't this culture also point to a very dangerous assumption that anybody in this nation could be treated like you just described you were treated and get away with it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There was a recent report in New York of a mother who was breastfeeding her daughter, and police, because she did not move fast enough or comply with his command, actually manhandled her in a way where her newborn baby fell to the ground from nursing on her breast, fell to the ground, and the baby died. And I believe this was a Caucasian woman, right? This kind of aggressive over-policing that is happening in our country is a serious problem. And I speak on this as someone who is actively engaged with the Department of Justice, with a number of national network for safe communities, police chief organizations. We're working on police legitimacy. We're working on repairing the harm that has happened historically between communities and law enforcement. I speak on this as someone who is actively involved in trying to strengthen police-community relationships. We need to make sure that law enforcement do not overreach. Right now, they're using military-style weapons and bringing those into our communities. The Department of Justice and the federal government, I think Homeland Security and others, are incentivizing and giving free weapons, tanks, and things to police agencies. This should not be present on the street of our cities. And part of the reason why this is happening, I remember after I was beat up by the police in 1999, we were having lots of conversations about this very thing. And 9/11 happened in 2001. I'm telling you, Dr. Gaddy, that before 9/11 happened, there was a massive move to address racial profiling, put cameras on police officers. There was all this movement, and 9/11 happened, and fear was introduced into our country's psyche in such a way where police and law enforcement pretty much have received a blank check since then, and now we have a militarized police force in our communities. It is not acceptable. And all of us should be concerned about it, not because we're anarchists or anti-government. It's because we are citizens of the United States of America. It's our tax dollars. We determine how law enforcement should be engaging our communities and not the other way around.
I'm quite sure that you have been on the phone with people in Ferguson. What are you hearing from people in Ferguson? And what are you saying to those people?
We've talked to a number of clergy, a number of young people. They've gotten on some of our national calls. They are afraid. Many of them said that they have never seen this amount of artillery. They're expressing how the tear gas and the rubber bullets are going through people's homes and lives that aren't even involved in any of the nonviolent protests that are happening outside. They acknowledge that there are a few folks out there who are resorting to violence, but they feel like they are being provoked by these weapons and tear gas thrown at their feet. They are asking us to come and help support them in doing some faith-based and nonviolent organizing. So we are preparing ourselves to go there and support them. There's a effort that we've already gotten over 100 congregations to join us this Sunday and Saturday on a Live Free Sabbath, where we're going to preach, pray, and act to try and help raise the awareness in our congregations to support what's happening there, but also reach out in our own communities. They're trying to figure out what can we do that's constructive. What can we do that can actually harness the energy and frustration of our city, but not burn the city to the ground, not cause us to not get the change that we want. There's a lot of pain in Ferguson right now, but there's a lot of courage and there's a lot of commitment to stay involved and to stay engaged. They're talking about registering people to vote, which is an amazing even thought to have young people saying we all need to get registered to vote because our city is 21,000 people, 67% of our city are African-American. We all should be more representative in the political leadership of the city. We should be more representative in the law enforcement of our city. the young people are already turning to peaceful civic participation strategies. These are the kinds of conversations that we're having with folks, and we're going to do everything we can to support them by showing up on the ground, raising some resources to help them start and continue the work so they can be able to have their own determination for how they want to live in their city and in their community.
One of the most frustrating things that I hear from others over and over is people who say, well, the president is black, so there can't be any more racism in our country. Now, I know what my answer to that attitude is, but I wish you'd tell me what your answer is and see if you can help me with that.
Well, I think that the president's race is a very important moment of triumph in our country, in the sense that we have been able to elect an African-American to the highest office of the land. It cannot be reduced, and it should not be reduced. It should not be minimized. It has been a historic accomplishment that, given the racial history we have in our country, that someone from a minority population, historically oppressed people group, has been able to elevate to that level of election. At the same time, one election does not reverse 400 years of structural racism. People must realize that when we're talking about racism, we're not talking about a person. We're talking about a structure and a system of laws and of rules that are often embedded at the local, state, and federal level. And it has taken almost 400 years to make these laws, rules, structures, and systems codified. So what we need to be thinking about as we have the conversation about racism is not our individual people guilty of racism, because that's a no-win situation, I believe, a no-win conversation. I believe a win-win conversation is when we can talk about the structures that all of us participate in. How are they grinding people of color, poor people, to dust because of our economic policies, the way we are racially discriminating against folk around loans, around the sentencing laws, around the suspension rules in our classrooms? These are the structural questions that we must tackle, realizing that structures are made up of people. So then the personal responsibility is for us all to take a look at how we are participating either in maintaining the status quo of structural racism or dismantling the structural racism that is within our purview. And I think that the president has a responsibility to do this, but it is just not up to him. It is up to all of us. In that way, the election of the president is not the elimination of racism in our country. It is not the evidence that racism is over. As a matter of fact, it possibly could be the signal that now we actually have the power and the ability to eliminate the racism if we all do our work to address the structure.
I'm grateful for your wisdom, and to know that you're in the middle of all of this gives me a lot more confidence about the possibility of transitioning to something that may even have some very positive results. Pastor Mike McBride leads Lifelines to Healing, part of the PICO Network. You can learn more about the Live Free Sabbath at lifelinestohealing.org. Pastor Mike, thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio and for doing the work you're doing.
God bless you, my brother. We're ready to make this work, and we all got the work to do together. Always great to be with you.